Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today is a man who's intimately involved in the Yorkshire Dales and the Woodlands, and has written about the area and the Three Peaks. And he's also a caver, I believe. So I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about. But he is, see if I get this right, the North Yorkshire Millennium Trust. He's basically the media officer, and also works for Plastic Free Woodlands. I've probably got most of that wrong, but my guest today is Mike Appleton, and he was introduced to me via Twitter when I somewhat rashly said who do my listeners want to hear, and Mike Appleton was one of those people. So how are you doing, Mike?
Yeah, pretty good, John. How about yourself?
I'm fine. Did I get any of that right?
Bits.
Well, bits. For me, that's pretty good.
Yeah, good.
So who do you really work for then?
Yeah, so I'm the Marketing and Communications Officer at Yorkshire Dales Millennium Trust. And I do that, that's my full-time role. But as part of my other role at the Trust, I'm the Project Officer for our Plastic Free Woodlands project.
So what's the Millennium Trust? What does it actually do?
Yeah, so wow, I can give you a proper spiel here. So we came out of the national park around about 1997. Obviously, the Millennium Commission were making grants and funds available for organisations to do good things in the community. So we came out of the national park almost as their kind of charitable arm in 1997. Uh-huh. I think I've only been at the Trust probably 2.5 years now, John. So from what I gather, I don't think we were supposed to be around that long. But you know, kind of 25 years we're still kicking on. So in that 25 years we've helped to support planting of 1.5 million trees. Restored hay meadows. We bring people out to the Dales who wouldn't get the opportunity to come out, so that's kind of refugees and asylum seekers and underrepresented groups from urban areas around, and that's really a, we do all sorts. We've got a community grants program as well that kind of helps, you know, some of the small villages in the Dales do something good for the community. There's a whole host of stuff, John. Honestly, I could bore you senseless for the next hour on that one.
Well, we've only got half an hour. So, tell it for people who don't know, describe the Dales to us. Tell us about the Dales.
Wow. Well, if you listen to my partner, she would say it is grim. In fact, she said to me last night, grim, windswept, featureless and green. That would be her kind of view of it. So obviously she's been on plenty of walks with me where I've bored her senseless pointing at various things. But I just think it's, I think you've got so much variety in the Dales. You've got the kind of, you know, obviously the rolling green hills that you get in the Lake District, that kind of that feature of the landscape. You know, it is a working landscape. So it's kind of heavily clipped by our sheep friends. But I also think you've got, you know, in the south of the park where you've got, you know, limestone cliffs and caves and obviously the Three Peaks as well. And then the further north you head, you know, you can head up to Sebba and Ravensea up there. That's kind of, you know, Courtly Spout, that's kind of quite dramatic, and the Howgills. It's got such a variety. And also in, I think it was 2016, was it? You know, the National Park was extended pretty much up to Tea Bay, and the Westmorland Dales have some of the best limestone pavements, I would say, in National Park. Probably better than Malin Cove, I would say. The limestone pavements on the top of Malin Cove, you know, up there at Great Aspie Scar.
So is Malin in the Yorkshire Dales? Tell us the scope of it, because I kind of got a rough idea, but tell us, Where do the Dales start and finish? If you describe it geographically, how's that?
Well, it's handy that I've got a map in front of me here, John, isn't it?
It does help.
On my wall, but you know, since the park extended, you know, it goes all. It does take in Kirby Stephen now. It goes up to pretty much Tea Bay Services
up that way.
And as you come down, it encompasses Sebba. And then even further down, Kirby Lonsdale and that kind of A65 from Ingleton to Settle, which takes you into Skipton at the bottom of the park, Bolton Abbey.
Right.
And then if you go up the kind of the west side, you it even just about touches Richmond as well. So it's a pretty big park. I think it's I do stand to be corrected on this, but I think it's something like 870 square miles in size, something like that.
Right,
that seems a little bit big now I'm saying it, but it could be kilometers, to be honest with you.
So you've basically no idea where it is. so I mean, I know that area a bit from a time when I used to live in England, and times when I've walked through the Pennine Way in various areas and done bits of gritstone edge climbing and that sort of stuff, you know. And it's a wild moorland area, really, isn't it?
It can be, especially in the north of the park, I would say. And you know, some of the stuff that we're doing at the Trust, you know, with helping to plant trees, you know, if there's something the Dales needs, it is trees.
Absolutely.
It is the, I think, outside.
Absolutely.
Let's just say, John, that London has more trees than the Yorkshire Dales.
Really? That doesn't kind of, in some ways, that doesn't surprise me, because trees in the Yorkshire Dales are, or certainly used to be when I first went there, sort of few and far between.
Yeah.
In fact, when I first walked, it's funny how your perceptions change, because when I first walked through that area, it seemed to me an incredible wild and remote landscape. But since I've lived in Scotland, I have come to understand the landscape better. I realize that it is far from a natural landscape. I'm really interested to hear that your a lot of your work is based on tree planting. So what's the aim of that, and how are you doing that?
Yeah, well, as I've said, you know, the Dales, especially in terms of broadleaf cover, mm-hmm. I think he's only around about 2.7% of the actual kind of land mass of the Dales.
Right.
It's actually covered in trees. I think it rises to around about 3.8, 3.9 if you include kind of conifer plantation,
and things
like that. You know, and if we want resilient landscapes into the future, you know, planting trees is the best way forward. So, obviously, planting trees helps mitigate climate change. It provides interest in the landscape. You know, it's good for biodiversity, and you know, on the flip side, it's well-being spaces for people as well. So as I say, we bring people out into the Dales to help us plant trees, you know, to some people from kind of rural urban areas of, mm-hmm. of Blackburn, say, and Leeds, Bradford, who've probably never come to the Dales before, you know, actually spending a day on the side of a windswept fell when it's chucking it down, you know, planting trees and you know, it's good for mental health, it's good for well-being. But I think that most people would probably agree, and this is obviously my opinion and not the opinion of the Trust, but I think most people would agree that the Dales does need trees, and you can do that in two ways. You can either, you know, plant trees, or you can leave it to rewild. And you know, I think with countryside stewardship schemes and you know, various schemes like that, giving farmers and landowners the opportunity to plant trees, and that's where we come in and help them do that and support them through the process. So yeah, it's something that I feel quite proud of being involved with, John. It's not something I've done in the past. My career has been based in I first started out in internal communications and then went to business communications and then moved into kind of sports journalism, involved in ice hockey, and also I worked for Settlers Rugby League Club,
right?
And that was my dream job at the time. Really was to work for my local club, and I did that for 13, 14 years, and then to get the opportunity to do what I do now in a place I love, I feel quite humble about it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, don't knock it. You've got it, and you've worked there, and you've done it. You know, that's the important thing. And obviously, it's a really valuable thing. I mean, one of the issues, my understanding, is that as you know, our climate's changing, and we are in an era where more extreme weather is likely to occur, and particularly, you know, periods of very heavy rainfall. And one of the issues, my understanding, is in the area that you're based in the Dales, is that some of the flooding that's occurred has been largely because the hills are bereft of trees. Am I right in thinking then that some of the forestry may have a role to play in preventing some of the flooding that's happening in more lowland areas?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a big push from government, isn't it? And I think DEFRA came out yesterday, and put a lot of things forward about kind of rewilding and tree planting and things like that. And I think it's well known that if you plant trees further up the river, you know, it slows the flow down, and you know, if you allow fields further up the river to flood, you know, it does mitigate potential issues further down. But then again, I also see the flip side as well, that, you know, if you've got a farmer who farms in an upland area, and, you know, the alternative is kind of dredge a river and move the water through pretty quick to another area, so that the land that they've got there is productive and they can graze on it, or having a field that's flooded, you know, you can see why farmers are kind of, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place. And unless they're actually paid to do that, you know, because they are trying to run a business, then it's difficult, isn't it, John? And
I think we're due
some major changes over the next few years, really. You know, the Elm is coming in, and obviously basic payments are being phased out, and I think upland farming in particular is gonna be an interesting time for those farmers, in my view, because obviously basic payments are disappearing. So, you know, especially some land production is quite heavily subsidized.
Yes.
So where's that money going to come from? And, you know, it's not especially in the upland areas, it's not an industry where you can put high outputs into high inputs to get high outputs either, is it? So
No, I think we're generally speaking, we're particularly in Scotland, I see it as well. You know, we're at a point, where we have to question what we've been trying to do with the landscape over the years. And I think quite brutally, in some places, the kind of farming that we've been subsidizing for years really can't continue. You know, I think we have to look into different ways of doing that sort of thing, which is pretty brutal for, I realize, for the people who've been making their living doing that for so long. But you have to wonder, you know, if it has to be supported financially so much, and is it giving the community and the environment, if you like, the kind of payback that we need? That's not an easy question, and I don't expect you to answer that. That's a pretty tricky question to answer. But do you get where do you see the Dales being, say, in 20 years' time? What sort of vision have you got for that area?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I can't speak on behalf of the trust, John, and just make
sure.
These are my own views. But
of course,
it does worry me, because I think that the Dales has as I said before, it's a working landscape and looks the way it does because of because of sheep and because of grazing and personally, I think, and I've tried to do a little bit of work on Elm and see where it's going and you know how the subsidy system's going to work, but I just can't see how an upland farmer in some of the ravages of the Dales without the basic payment is going to be able to survive. Now, I don't think the government have explained very well what's going to happen. It's kind of, oh well, you can plant trees on your land and we'll give you some cash. Or is that going to be yearly? Is that going to be like just one lump sum? And I think there needs to be some clarity. There definitely needs to be clarity going forward. I think there is a little bit of making it up as they go along at the moment. But I just can't see how, without some kind of regular payment for food production, how some of these farms are going to survive without massive diversification. And for some, that's just not possible. So I think it's going to completely change the landscape of the Dales. I don't think we'll notice it in 20 years, because some of these areas will probably just kind of rewild very, very slowly and go from, you know, kind of bracken to shrub and move on like that. But just such a big change coming up. And it is a worry. It's a worry. I've got, you know, a lot of farmers, a lot of people I speak to who just want some kind of clarity going forward. On the other side, you know, I suppose we need to ask the general public what they're prepared to pay for. And the fact that Elm doesn't say that producing food is a public good is a bit strange. But are people going to be happy for paying more for the meat as a result? Obviously, if farmers are not getting as much money in through basic payment or the Elm scheme, they're going to have to put the price up of lamb and things like that. So,
you
know, but I think people do pay for quality, John. I think we have seen that. over the, especially meat eaters. I'm not a meat eater myself, but I think people pay for quality.
Yeah.
It's just how that's going to manifest in the future, really.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to get into the whole debate as to whether effectively the kind of, I suppose, the carnivore diet that we've enjoyed for so long, whether that continues to be sustainable, and whether that's something that we should want to pursue. But getting back to the area, I mean, one of the things about Dales is as opposed to where I live in the Highlands, is that it's a populated area. You know, all of it pretty much is used for something, for sheep or for whatever. But you also said that one of your interests is caving, and that's something that is different. So tell us about the caving in the Dales. What's that all about?
Oh, it's the best caving in the world. I think, and I'm only a relative novice compared to some of the people that I cave with. So I'm a member of the Red Rose Caving and Pothole Club.
Oh, right.
Which is based in, where would the best place to say it based? Based kind of in Barben, which as of recently wasn't part of the national park. You know, it was included in the extensions. And the Easegill system there, which, you know, connects three counties, so kind of Cumbria, Lancashire and Yorkshire, has got probably 90 kilometres of passage now, John. And, you know, some of my fellow cavers are kind of diving and pushing various sumps and digging in other places. So that's only going to grow and grow. It's just, yeah, my dad was really into caving. So my dad was a fireman from St Helens who would go up to the, Dales, because a colleague that he worked with had a house in Dent. So I was lucky to go up as a kind of 8-9 year old and
spend
a couple of days in Dent now and again. And he would disappear off caving, and then, you know, took me through a very, very easy cave system near Ingleton. And I hated it. I hated every minute of it. But I kind of realised that, you know, that kind of exploration is quite exciting. And just now I just got the opportunity with the caving club to kind of throw myself down pitches and slide on ropes and things like that.
Yeah. It's
something I love, and it's something that I've included in my writing quite a bit.
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, one of the things about caving, it strikes me, as opposed to the sort of hill walking stuff that I do, is that there's still an unexplored landscape underground, and there are places that you can still go somewhere. I suppose you can still go somewhere where no other human being has ever set foot or shoved his lamp into. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think a lot of the discoveries that have been made are probably as far as some of the systems will go without kind of major engineering projects. Mm-hmm. And you know, but there's still, you know, I've got a friend who's been diving under Malham Cove for 30 odd years to try and find the obvious cave system that's under there. And, you know, after 30 years of work, reached a passage that would just involve absolute major engineering to push it forward. So just decided to stop after 30 years and explore another side passage that's now starting to push.
Right,
so,
okay.
Giving up 30 years of work to go and explore the passage. But yeah, there's still discoveries out there. I mean, even, you know, I've been in some of the really kind of popular systems like the Longchurn and Alan Pot at Selside, which is well used by groups and children's groups and things like that. And even going through there, you just get the sense that, you know, especially if you're on your own, I do cave on my own now and again, you're the only person there, and it's very new and different. I'm sure the darkness helps as well. But yeah, it's fascinating. And cavers are a special breed as well, John. They're, you know, hard cavers, hard drinkers, you know, always got a story to tell. And I just like being around people who, you know, to have that kind of fascination of exploration. That's kind of what interests me.
Of the limited amount of caving that I've done, I did discover it had one major advantage, and that is there's no point in getting up early in the morning. Because it's when you're hill walking and climbing, sometimes you've got to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. But caving, that does no real point to that, because it's always going to be dark. You mentioned a bit about your writing. Tell us about I think you told me you'd written 10 books on the outdoors. Tell us a little bit about your writing and where you've been going with that.
So I think it's 7 books on the outdoors and 6 books outdoors, 4 sporting. I got the opportunity to do kind of 3 sports autobiographies before I got the bug to do a travel book, I guess. I did the book of Tony Hand MBE, who's an ice hockey player who was drafted into the NHL. He was the first Brit to be drafted into the NHL. And I learned a lot from that book. I'd love to write that one again, to be honest with you, John. I don't know whether you look over the stuff that you've written and think, oh, I wish I'd have done that better. But it was kind of my first book, and I'd love to go back and write it again.
I look back over some of my writing and think I probably shouldn't have done that at all, basically. Oh no, I think that's quite right. That you're continuously developing as a writer, or at least I hope so. And I often look back at stuff and think, oh God, why didn't I do that differently? But the thing is, I always think you can only write, if you like, in the moment as where you are at that stage. And if you waited until you thought you were perfect as a writer, you'd never produce anything, would you?
Yeah, that's true. I think with that first book, because I was used to interviewing people for my role anyway, and for my job, and I was into ice hockey at the time, and I was doing provincial reporting, writing reports for local papers and things like that. Yeah. And I wanted to do something more, so I did that book. And I think now, if I look back at the kind of the outdoor books that I've done, and I look at that kind of first autobiography that I did for the ice hockey player, I wish I'd know now knew then what I know now, really, and how to create a narrative a little bit better. But I'm still proud of that book. And after that, I did two rugby league books. A chap called Kel Coslett, who was an old player. I say an old player, kind of former player who played in the 70s, and also a kind of a modern day great in Lee Breers, who played for Warrington St Helens as well. And once I'd done those 3, I just thought, I'm putting other people's words onto a page. And whilst it's good and I enjoy doing their stories, I wanted to put my own voice forward a little bit. So I approached a publisher who I think was involved in Tony's book, the first book, and ended up writing almost a snapshot of the Three Peaks. It's a bit of a trite title, and I still don't like the title, but it was Yorkshire's Three Peaks, the inside story of the Dales. Ugh, I don't like that title, but that's what the publisher wanted to go with.
Just in case there's people listening, I'm sure there will be. I'm sure people don't know what you mean by the Three Peaks. Tell us what Three Peaks are you talking about there?
Yeah, it's Ingleborough, Penigent, and Wernside in the southern area of the national park. I think obviously connected together by a 26 mile walk that if you do in 12 hours or less, you kind of complete the Yorkshire Dales Challenge. And yeah, I wanted to do a little bit of a journalistic piece on what was happening in that area at the time. So this is around about 2012. So it covers kind of social economic impacts. The walk starts itself in Horton in Ribblesdale. I spoke to kind of business owners there, and obviously in the summer, and it's worse now, John. In the summer, you could almost have like 1,000 cars parked up around there and in fields and things like that to complete that challenge walk and kind of get a view of the locals of how that feels. I spoke to the national park about path maintenance. I spoke to the chap who actually owns Penigent, the actual hill, and how he felt, cave rescue. So there's loads of different people that I interviewed on the way with trying to come up with a conclusion about how the area can be managed for future generations. So it is my intention at some point to go back and almost follow up on that book. Whether that's 20 years after it's been published, and try and interview everybody I interviewed in that book and find out what's happened in the past 20 years. Now, sadly, I know one of the farmers has passed away in an accident a few years ago, and,
right.
and a couple of the other farmers have moved on as well. So, but yeah, it'd be good to kind of follow up on that book. And then from there, I kind of got involved in, 50 Gems of the Yorkshire Dales and 25 Great Walkers Pubs and books like that. You know, those list books, John, I guess.
Yeah.
I think we were talking about off air that I'm not a big fan of bucket lists. I tried to include a bit of narrative in there as well. Little kind of stories and interviews in those gems and great pubs and things like that, just to kind of break up the text.
50 great pubs. Now you've given me a great idea. 50 great pubs. must have been a terrible task doing that, wasn't it?
Horrendous. It wasn't just a pub because it serves great beer, although that helps. It's kind of, historic pubs. Acted as courthouses in the past. And that was good. And then I returned to rugby league to write the book of Danny Sculthorpe, I'd advise anybody to read that book about how somebody could come right back from the brink of, doing something stupid because of kind of mental health issues.
And that
came off the back of just the most horrendous injuries through playing the sport.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best book I've written, I think. And then after I'd done that one, back to 50 Gems of Derbyshire and Cheshire. And now I've just written a book on Secret Dales.
November. When is that coming out? In November, so
it was,
you say?
Yeah, it was due to come out in April 2020. And the publisher took the opinion that they weren't quite sure how book sales would go in the pandemic.
Because of the pandemic,
Kind of 6 months later, book sales have gone really well, John, haven't they? Because nobody had anything to do.
I certainly hope so. And you said something which struck a chord with me when we were talking about this earlier. You said that I think you felt that the during lockdown, during the pandemic, it had been very difficult to be creative. How did that affect you then?
Yeah, I think it was probably twofold for me. Because the book was delayed, so I was pretty excited about it coming out in April. And then we did think that we could possibly launch it in November last year.
Right.
I'm quite excited about that. And then I think the publisher had such a backlog of books that mine was eventually put back again to April this year and then also to November this year. And I think I got a little bit of malaise about that, really.
Yeah.
Because
you
build yourself up, don't you, for a book launch and kind of ideas about publicity and podcasts and things like that. And then I just felt with the pandemic, you weren't allowed to go anywhere. Malaise of, not being able to launch the book that I was quite proud of doing. And then also not being allowed out. I kind of went into myself quite a lot and, didn't leave the house for a long time.
Yes.
And, I think, you looked on social media at the time and there was people starting courses, there was people doing big projects and, lots of decorating going on. And, Instagram's a fraud, isn't it? It really is.
It's all bollocks, I found it, you would think that for a writer, being locked in your house with a project to work on would kind of almost be ideal because, it's reduced the distractions. And it kind of felt that like that at first, but then I found it increasingly difficult as lockdown progressed to be creative, largely because, I think because, you need a balance in life. You can sit down and write something, which is, a great process, but also a demanding process as well. You can do that, but also you need the outlet. You need to get out. You need to meet people. You need to be out in the outdoors and feel the wind on your face and that sort of stuff. And without that, I found that, like you, I sort of sank into a sort of malaise. Does that sort of ring a bell with you?
It does. It's that external influence on your writing, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm sure not all authors were the same. And my favourite author is a chap called Willie Vlautin, who is the lead singer of Richmond Fontaine, and he's written a load of books, kind of real noir books based in kind of Portland in the States, and you know, looking at kind of real down and out characters. And I remember seeing an interview with him, and he said, "Well, I've been touring for the past 20 years, and I've not been home. So this is brilliant. I can now stay at home for a couple of years and actually do some writing." But I just really miss that external. I mean, I'm quite a loner anyway, John, but I miss that external contact of being out and about.
Oh, God.
You know, I think, I mean, as a trust, we all decamped to our various homes, and our meetings went up. So we were speaking to each other a lot more than we probably would do in the office, but it was all kind of behind the screen. And I think also with working from home and then trying to write from home as well, I felt I'd done my writing during the day as part of my work. So I didn't really want to start anything in the evening, whereas, you know, all my books have been written in you know, late into the night, when I've been working during the day somewhere else and then coming home, getting a laptop out and doing what I need to do.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I mean, a lot of, you know, I think some people thought, oh, the ability to work from home must be fantastic. But there is something about that in that, you know, when you go out and you go to an office or you go somewhere to work or whatever, you go there, you do your work, you come home, and you've got like two separate lives.
Yes.
But when you're working from home, the two things sort of bleed together. That was my experience. I don't know if that was yours.
Yeah. I felt that when I was doing my day job at home, I'd done my writing for the day, and then you know I've got a young family at home as well, and then by the time then, you know, we get them to bed, it's kind of 7 o'clock, and you're thinking,
yeah.
I don't really want to pick my laptop again and start on something else. I've done my work today already, and yeah, so I've almost taken. Probably, I would say a year off writing, and I think that's reflected on my website as well, with some of my blog posts. I kind of talk about, you know, struggling to be creative, and it's only recently that I've wanted to start writing again and try to start work on a new project as well.
So, what's your new project? Where are you going next, do you think?
Well, I'm hoping to do some kind of well, probably not an A to Z of the Dales, but you know, some kind of these are things that you can find in the Dales that are nowhere else. So we're talking, you know, special kind of species.
Oh, like a kind of guide in a way.
Yeah. You know, hardest, longest, deepest cave systems, kind of notable people,
sounds
changes
good.
In farming and things like that. So, yeah, that's what I'm looking at the moment.
A sort of picture of the Dales, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
That sounds really great. Yeah. I'm sure. Listen, it's been fascinating talking to you. And if folk want to, can I put a link on the podcast page that'll take people to your books and your writing? And you're also a podcaster as well, and some of the stuff that you do. Is that okay?
Yeah, that would be great. And if anybody wants a chat and, you know, wants to tell fellow authors how to get out of the pit of malaise, you know, we'd be quite happy to form a support group, wouldn't we, John? We can rent a basement somewhere and
we can talk
about it, can't we?
Sit in a cellar in the dark.
Yeah, exactly.
A cave might be the best. I felt like I was in a cave for quite a while, actually. Anyway, it's been fantastic talking to you. I'll put links to what you've been doing, and maybe when your book comes out in November, we can talk again and round about its launch. And let's hope you get a physical launch rather than one of these bloody internet things, you know?
Yeah, here's hoping.
Here's hoping. Thanks very much for your time, Mike. Lovely speaking to you.
You too, John.